President Trump has signed an emergency bill to help Americans hit financially by the coronavirus pandemic.
Just days after the House of Representatives met in person to vote on the bill, two members test positive for COVID-19.
I'm David Greene with Rachel Martin, and this is Up First from NPR News. At least 3 weeks ago, one senator warned that the coronavirus would be very disruptive. This is according to a secret tape obtained by NPR.
It is much more aggressive in its transmission than anything that we have seen in recent history.
So why wasn't that the government's message to Americans at that time?
The U.S. is partially shutting down the border to our north and could do the same to the south. How are travel restrictions affecting immigration and the people already waiting at the border to get in? Stay with us. We've got the news you need to start your day.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Chobani Oat, made to taste just like milk. It's creamy, frothy, and great with coffee and cookies, but without the dairy, because it's not milk. It's almost milk. New Chobani Oat.
Hopefully, at this point, most of us are trying to heed the advice from public health officials. Stay home, and if you can't, stay 6 feet away from the next person. But even so, some transmission of COVID-19 is inevitable.
That's right. And now two House members are the first lawmakers to announce that they have tested positive for the coronavirus. They say they are experiencing symptoms of COVID-19. We're talking about Florida Republican Mario Diaz-Balart and Utah Democrat Ben McAdams. Both congressmen have been on the House floor in recent days, including on Saturday when Congress was voting for an emergency aid bill. We should say President Trump has since signed that bill into law.
We've got NPR congressional correspondent Susan Davis with us. Hi, Sue.
Hey, Rachel.
So we're going to get to the emergency bill in a minute, but first, let's acknowledge that it's pretty likely everyone has or will be touched by this pandemic at some point, including members of Congress. What can you tell us about the situation for these two lawmakers who tested positive?
Well, they both disclosed their diagnosis last night, and they said that they started to become symptomatic on Saturday night, the evening after they took that vote. Mario Diaz-Balart said he never left D.C. He started to feel symptoms, and so he stayed in his apartment here because he said his wife has a pre-existing condition, and he was mindful that he didn't want to go home and travel with it. McAdams is back in Utah. He gave an interview to his local paper. He told them that he felt pretty sick, that he was having coughing, and it felt like a, quote, belt tightening around his chest. Neither said they know how they contracted it, but I don't think these diagnoses come as a surprise. I think considering especially the close quarters of Capitol Hill, people were bracing as a matter of when and not if members would start to be diagnosed.
Right. So we mentioned that they were on the House floor to vote recently. So presumably they were in close contact with hundreds of people. Are there efforts now underway to trace everyone else who might have been affected as a result?
Yes. McAdams said in his own disclosure he could recount 12 members that he had direct contact with. Capitol Hill has an attending physician, someone who works directly with lawmakers. They put out a statement last night saying they're working with both of them to essentially retrace their steps, figure out who they would have been in contact with. Already, there have been five additional lawmakers who have disclosed not that they are symptomatic, but that they had contact with one or the other of those members, and they've announced self-quarantining until March 27th. This includes two members of the Republican leadership team, Minority Whip Steve Scalise and their chief deputy whip, Drew Ferguson, who's a Republican from Missouri. The question that we have now, right, is will the House reconvene and when? They are scheduled to come back into session next week. We don't have answers yet as to whether that will be postponed or if they will essentially call the House back into session next week.
Mm-hmm. All right. So let's talk about this emergency aid bill. President Trump has signed it. What does it include?
The three major things in this wave is it includes mandates for free testing for people, it expands unemployment insurance benefits, and a new paid sick leave guarantee that should help out millions of workers. Reminder, this is the second bill Congress already approved about an initial wave of $9 billion. They are already working on a third wave estimated to be about $1 trillion that should be coming soon that will be made up of small business loans and probably direct payments to American workers.
How fast, Sue, will Americans feel the impact of these stimuli?
It's a good question. The lawmakers I talked to say weeks, not months. Part of it is they need to put in these sort of new infrastructures in place to get these systems out. But the Senate is saying they are not going out of session until they pass this next wave because they know that people need help essentially right away.
Right. NPR Susan Davis, we appreciate it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. So we heard several Republicans and the president himself actually downplaying the coronavirus for weeks. But one senator actually issued an early warning that the coronavirus could disrupt everything.
Yes, that senator is Republican Richard Burr. He's the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And we know about his warning because NPR's Tim Mak got his hands on a secret recording of Burr talking with business and civic leaders last month.
There's one thing that I can tell you about this. It is much more aggressive in its transmission than anything that we have seen in recent history. It's probably more akin to the 1918 pandemic.
So as you can hear, this was a more urgent warning than most Americans were hearing at that time. The Republican senator's comments are raising questions about why an audience at a private luncheon on Capitol Hill would be getting a more frank assessment of this situation than the general public.
We've got NPR's Tim Mak with us now. Hey, Tim.
Hey there.
Where'd the tape come from and who was he talking to?
So he was talking at a luncheon organized by the Tar Heel Circle, and that is an organization that consists of businesses and organizations from North Carolina. That's the state that Senator Burr represents. Now, yeah. Membership in the Tar Heel Circle can cost between $500 and $10,000. Burr was talking candidly about his assessment about how bad the coronavirus might become in the United States. And the tape comes from an attendee who became alarmed about Burr's dire warnings, so began to record.
So what else did Senator Burr have to say to that group?
Well, Burr warned well in advance that the coronavirus could be very disruptive. 13 days before the State Department began to warn against travel to Europe, and 15 days before the Trump administration banned European travelers to the U.S., Burr warned those in the room to reconsider.
Every company should be cognizant of the fact that you may have to alter your travel. You may have to look at your employees and judge whether the trip they're making to Europe is essential or whether it can be done on video conference. Why risk it?
And 16 days before North Carolina closed its schools due to the threat of coronavirus, Burr warned it could happen. And it's only now, 3 weeks later, that the public is learning in earnest about how the military might be mobilized to combat this threat. But Senator Burr invoked this prospect when talking about how the country might have to surge its medical capacity.
Was he saying the same thing publicly, or is this dramatically different?
Well, nowhere in press statements or other remarks did Senator Burr provide warnings about how bad he worried the coronavirus crisis would become. And I think what's interesting about this story is that Burr was providing a stark assessment about coronavirus to a small audience of constituents, which as an elected official, he never told the general public about. This story raises questions about whether Senator Burr was truly frank with the public about how bad the coming weeks might be. And that same day, here's what the president said about the coronavirus.
It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear. Yes. And from our shores, it could get worse before it gets better. It could maybe go away. We'll see what happens.
So you reached Senator Burr's office yesterday for comment. I understand what they say.
Well, Senator Burr's spokesperson stressed that the senator has been a longtime advocate of public health preparedness and that he's long worked to educate the public about the tools and resources our government has to confront the spread of this crisis. Burr's spokesperson also said that every American should take the threat very seriously.
All right, NPR's Tim Mak. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
The Trump administration wants to keep as few people as possible from crossing its land borders to the north and the south.
Right. And the administration says this is to control the spread of the coronavirus. But these measures also greatly reduce immigration into the United States. And as NPR's John Burnett has found, the government has already slowed the processing of immigrants here.
John joins us now on the line from Austin. Hey, John. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Rachel.
Let's take a look first at our northern border with Canada. What's going on there right now?
Well, President Trump said yesterday that by mutual consent, the U.S. and Canada will halt all non-essential traffic. Details are still scarce as to how this will be defined and enforced, but both governments are recommending their citizens return home as soon as possible. Here's the president at that midday press conference yesterday.
It's not affecting trade, so things like that. But just leisurely, let's go to a restaurant and have dinner, which a lot of people do. They come both ways. They go in both directions. That kind of thing we have ended on a temporary basis.
And it's important for both countries that it doesn't affect trade. The U.S. and Canada have one of the largest trading relationships in the world. $2 billion a day in goods and services cross the border. And still there are health concerns on both sides of the border. Canada has fewer than 700 coronavirus cases. The U.S. now has more than 8,700. And you know, British Columbia shares a border with Washington State, which has had one of the biggest outbreaks of COVID cases.
All right. So that's Canada. What about looking to the south? What about the border with Mexico?
Right. Well, keep in mind, our neighbors are more afraid of us than we are of them. Mexico has around 100 reported cases, far less than the U.S. Trump told reporters he does not foresee closing the southern border as he has the northern border. But he said he would invoke powers very soon that could ban asylum seekers to keep out communicable diseases. Immigrant advocates are already promising a legal challenge, saying the White House is exploiting this pandemic to push its anti-immigrant agenda.
So what about asylum seekers who are stuck in Mexico waiting for their cases to be resolved? How might this affect them?
Well, you know, there's some 25,000 migrants seeking asylum who are staying in these dangerous Mexican border cities. The worst is probably that sprawling refugee camp in Matamoros, just across the international bridge from Brownsville, Texas. One of them is Yamali. She's a young mother from Honduras with three kids, and she asked us not to use her last name. She was interviewed inside of her tent. She says they're in a precarious living condition and feel very vulnerable to the pandemic. They're all living cheek by jowl in this park together. They line up in the chow line twice a day. Their tents are all jammed together. So 6-foot social distancing recommended by public health experts for them is a fantasy.
Right. That's not realistic. More broadly, John, how is the coronavirus affecting the overall immigration system?
Well, wow. I mean, coronavirus isn't just affecting the borders. It's slowing everything down. Lots of immigration courts and immigration offices have locked their doors. We got an email last night from ICE that said they're only going to arrest criminal immigrants, and they're changing their rules, too.
NPR's John Burnett reporting for us this morning. John, we appreciate it. Thank you. And that's up first for this Thursday, March 19th. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm David Green. We'll be back here tomorrow. Hope you'll be with us again. And we know that the news does not end when this podcast is over. So you can follow us on Twitter. We are at Up First, and we'll give you a daily roundup of the most important stories of the day.
And if you are looking for more news about the coronavirus, NPR has got this new daily podcast exactly for that. It's called Coronavirus Daily, and they're going to have new episodes every weekday in the late afternoon. Check it out.
Change is hard, transitions can be even harder, but they're also an opportunity to explore and discover and reimagine things you thought you knew. I'm Manoush Zomorodi, the new host of NPR's TED Radio Hour, and with all this in mind, we've decided to make my entire first episode about reinvention. Subscribe or listen right now.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the University of Pennsylvania. At Penn, students and faculty are finding new ways to make the world a better place. Named fourth most innovative university in the world by Reuters, it's all discovered, taught, and made at Penn.